taking my life in my hands. And one of my children who survived homeschool is Amber. And she even got a husband that agreed to marry her, a homeschooler. So there is hope for your children that they might find a nice person when it comes that time in life. So there is hope. Okay. Yeah, driver's ed, that was an interesting time, taking your life in your hands. The kids, they figured that slowing down in snow was 5 miles an hour from 55 to 50 with snow-packed roads. I said, no, no, no. But anyway, that was fun, but I thought that was enough time. When I started teaching history, I was taught, I went to public school and I hated history. It was boring, having to memorize these facts and figures. I said, why? It doesn't make any sense. There was no story to it. And when I started teaching private school, when we started homeschooling our kids up in Portland, I was taught by the owner to teach history in story form, blending secular and religious history together. Well, I'd grown up in the public school, you take religion out of history, you can't talk about God, can't talk about religion, and it's like, then why are you studying history? Just memorizing facts and figures. Well, no wonder I was bored to death. But I started learning the history stories as I prepared these stories for teaching my school, my class. And it became fascinating. And putting religion and God back into history helped me understand what in the world it was. And I want to share with you some of those stories today. Under the premise that we are trying to build character in our children. And a good deal of character can come from the examples of those who've gone before us in history. And oftentimes, we did this when we homeschooled our kids and they were all at home, is we would create a theme for the month, theme for the week, whatever it was that we were doing. And I want to entitle this, You, a Hero in the Making. And we all have a mission to accomplish that God has given us. And he will tell you what that mission is if you're humble enough to pray for it and humble enough to receive it when he gives you the answer. When I was going to George with Oliver DeMille, for any of those who know Oliver DeMille, great guy. He started George Wythe University in Cedar City. And I graduated from there in 98, and I published my first book in 99. And we had to give an acceptance speech with our graduation. And so I got up there, and I was explaining to him what I was in the process, or the whole audience, what I was in the process of doing, which was writing my history curriculum. It took me 14 years to write. And I got the first one published the next year, in 99. But I was telling my story about what I was doing with my degree that I'd gotten from George Wythe. And he come up to me afterwards, and he says, I want you to send a copy of your first manuscript to me. And if I like it, I'll give you the foreword to put in it. And 2 weeks later, I got a foreword. One thing you have to remember about Oliver, it has to be a classic. And a classic is a book that can be reread and you can learn new stuff each time you reread it. It's not just a novel. No, there's some meat and potatoes to it. One paragraph I would like to share with you from that preface that he gave. Our world needs a return to a widespread study of history, a resurgence of heroes and stories which anchor difficult choices, and a restoration of the storytelling method which teaches historical fact in the exciting format of stories. Who's the greatest storyteller of all? The master. We remember his stories because they were things that we could apply in our own lives. Our youth need a foundation of the great epics of human history in order to see where they themselves fit, to give them the tools of leadership and effective decision-making, and in order to help them be rooted in the acquired knowledge of humanity's achievement. You as homeschool parents have the privilege, I know some days you might not think it's a privilege, but you have the privilege to teach your children that God gave you to prepare them for the mission that He has prepared for them to do. And you have been chosen to be the teacher. Therefore, that puts a great deal of responsibility on you to find out about your own child, and you're going to have to get on your knees to do it. And then teach that child what the Lord wants you to teach them for them to accomplish what He wants them to do. That's a heavy responsibility. And a lot of parents shy away from it. Oh, I can't homeschool. Well, it takes a particular character to do that. A great educator and religious person, David O. McKay, made the following comment. True education does not assist merely in the acquiring of a few facts of science, history, literature, or art, but in the development of character. True education awakens a desire to conserve health by keeping the body clean and undefiled. True education trains in self-denial and self-mastery. True education regulates the temper, subdues passion, and makes obedience to social laws and moral order a guiding principle of life. It develops reason and inculcates faith in the life of God, in the living God as the eternal loving Father of all. Don't leave. That's what you get to do. That is your privilege to do as the parents of the children that God gave you. Now, I've chosen 7 character attributes of a hero. And I want to share a history story to exemplify or illustrate those 7 characteristics. Before I get into those 7, first of all, who would you say is probably the greatest hero of the United States?
George Washington.
George Washington. Why? What is it about George Washington that he is the great? He's the only person who's been elected president twice unanimously. None of the others can make that claim. Okay? What was it about George Washington that made him so revered and loved? Any guesses?
Humility.
Humility. Okay. When he was 13 years old, he decided he wanted to be a good Christian boy. And so he wrote down 110 maxims that he memorized and incorporated into his life. And because he did that, he became our hero. Now, you can evaluate yourself, you can evaluate your kids, and see how you're doing. I just picked a few of these. Sleep not when others speak. How many of you have fallen asleep? Somebody else has been talking. Sit not when others stand. Why would he give that one? Why would he do that? Ties in with what you said. He realized he's not the most important person. That other person might be more important than him. Therefore, he learned as a small boy, stand up as a show of respect to whoever it is. Speak not when you should hold your peace. Walk not when others stop. In the presence of others, sing not to yourself with a humming noise, nor drum your fingers or toes. I'm quite sure how you drum your toes, but anyway, I imagine tapping your foot. Okay. If you cough, sneeze, sigh, or yawn, do it not loudly, but privately. And speak not in your yawning, but put your handkerchief or hand before your face and turn aside. Turn not your back to others, especially in speaking. Jog not the table or desk upon which another is writing or reading, and lean not upon anyone else. Stand up. If you read George Washington's history, you can see various aspects of these at maxims as he would come across those kinds of situations and behave how he did. But he learned those 110 and made himself a hero that we all respect. So let's talk about our first attribute. It's honesty. Now, there's lots of different attributes. I just picked these. And we're going to start with George Washington on this. We're back at the end of the Revolutionary War. Battle of Yorktown was won when Cornwallis surrendered on October 19, 1781. So we need to remember that date. 7 months after Yorktown. So this puts it March of 82. So the war's been over for 7 months. If any of you have ever read anything about the Revolution and Congress and how this army was treated, the states functioned under what was called the Articles of Confederation. They all had to agree 100% before anything could be done. And there was great jealousy between the states. They were all sovereign, and seldom would they agree on anything. Well, we're not going to pay our taxes because Maryland over here has a piece of our land that we think is ours, and we're not going to pay the tax until they give us the land back. Well, Maryland said, well, we won't give the land back until North Carolina does this with South Carolina. And it went on and on and on, so nothing was done to fund or feed the military. What a way to run a war. We should never have won the war. But the hand of Providence was otherwise. So not only had they gone through 7 years of war without food, without clothes, without money, they're standing around, the war's been won, but there's no peace treaty. For 7 months now, just twiddling their thumb in their toes. Okay. One day, Colonel Louis Nicola came up to Washington and gave him a letter. Washington read the letter and he was very disturbed. Because in the letter, it was an offer to make him King George I of the United States. We just fought a war to get rid of a king. And now you want to throw everything away and you want another king. I might be a good guy, but the next one might be a doofus. Just like King George III was. We're not going to gain, it's like Israel. Oh, we don't want a king, we don't want judges anymore. We want a king to be like everybody else. Well, congratulations, you got it, and you failed miserably. So Washington is very disturbed. My land, everything is falling apart. All the soldiers are feeling this way. But Washington also appreciated their feelings and concerns. But nothing, so he said, we're working on these issues. Washington tries to talk to the troops, but he knows it doesn't go very far. But he continues working with what he's been working with Congress. He had enough honesty to not accept the offer to be king. All he had to do was say, okay, issue's done. Because they all knew what kind of a man he was. He would take care of things. Congress is as weak as ever. The poverty of the army was just as bad as when they were fighting. 10 more months have now passed. Still no peace treaty. We're still on duty. Now Washington hears that there is going to be a revolt, and they will either force him to be king or they'll appoint someone else. Understandably, the troops are frustrated. A biographer, James T. Flexner, wrote this about Washington speaking to his officers about this effort. And by the way, I probably won't get through this without getting emotional. The officers stirred impatiently in their seats, and then suddenly every heart missed a beat. Washington was trying to read a letter of what he was proposing with members of Congress. There were some wealthy men in Congress who were willing to bail out the army, but it was taking time for them to get their finances in place and to be able to do what needed to be done and all that. And so Washington was in the midst of doing this. And so he's going to read this letter of what's trying to be done. But understandably, with the soldiers, they're tired of waiting. How long is this going to take? So he's trying to read the letter. The officers stirred impatiently in their seats, and suddenly every heart missed a beat. Something was the matter with His Excellency. He seemed unable to read the paper. He paused in bewilderment. He fumbled in his waistcoat pocket and then pulled out something that only his intimates had seen him wear. Anybody know what they are?
Glasses.
He explained, "Gentlemen, you will permit me to put on my spectacles, for I have not only grown gray, but almost blind in the service of my country." That simple statement achieved what all Washington's rhetoric and all of his arguments had been unable to achieve. The officers were instantly in tears, and from behind their shining eyes, their eyes looked with love at their commanding officer who had led them so far for so long. Washington quietly finished reading his letter to the Congress, walked out of the room, mounted his horse, and disappeared from view. As those who had fought beside Washington in the heat of many battles pondered his words, they voted unanimously with one abstention to support their leader in his efforts to right the wrongs. Because of the kind of man Washington was, they knew he was honest. I forgot to show that. This is a picture of Washington about the time he was general of the armed forces. Okay, a little bit different than the picture we normally see when he is as president. I wanted to show that because it took me a while to find that picture. Next attribute, courage. Now, This one I need to give you a little bit of a history lesson. This deals with Israel. After World War I, Great Britain took over the Holy Land as the controlling ruler. And Great Britain was trying to resolve the issues between the Arabs and the Jews. The Jews wanted their own homeland. The Arabs said no. Back and forth, skirmishes. Israel saw that they were going to need to have an army. They formed an army, but Great Britain wouldn't let them have many weapons because the Arabs would get upset with that, and they had been there longer, so they had more bombs and bazookas and tanks and everything else. And finally, at the end of World War II, Great Britain said, okay, we're done. We're giving this over to the UN. You guys can figure it out. So it was decided in the UN to create a separate country of Israel, carved out from among the Arab states. And the birth date for Israel was May 14, 1948. And the Arabs said, that will never happen. If you don't rescind this, we will attack Israel at 12:01 on the 14th. To give you a little bit of idea, I don't know how many of you can see this, but the green is Israel. Notice how you got the tan surrounding Israel. And you got other Arab countries all around here too. You see how Israel is surrounded by Arabs, trying to carve out Israel amongst this. Jerusalem is right here. Jerusalem is divided up into four parts. Christian, Jew, Arab, and forget what the other one was. But anyway, it's going to be in four parts. In the middle of Arab territory, but the Jews were going to have, anybody else was going to have free access to and from Jerusalem, even though it was going to be in Arab territory. So you can see Israel's already got a problem. They're surrounded by the enemy. So the attack begins. And true to their word, the Arabs attack from eight different directions, all within a month's period. No way in the world can the Jews hold out on this. They've got an army of 12,000. The Arabs have an army of 30. 3-to-1 ratio. Plus, the Jews had 1,000 guns, 1,000 machine guns. But they had lots of tin cans. And they would run their guns from various surroundings, various places. Some would shoot the guns, others would beat the tin cans to make it sound like there was a lot of weapons being fired at. Zechariah makes the comment in his writings, in the last days, the Lord will fight Israel's battles for them. And the Jews believe that. And they believe it today. To illustrate one way in which the Lord did this, in the Bible, in John, we learn of a promise made by the Savior to John the Beloved. It says, then Peter, turning about, seeth the disciple whom Jesus loved following, which also leaned on his breast at supper, and said, Lord, who is he that betrayeth me? So we're down to that point in the Savior's life, and he said, somebody's going to betray me. Peter's wanting to know who it's going to be. And John's following as Jesus and Peter are walking along. Peter, seeing him, saith to Jesus, Lord, and what shall this man do? Jesus saith to him, if I will that he tarry till I come, what is that to thee? Follow thou me. I accept that as its word and believe that John is still alive. So it was changed in a twinkling of an eye when it was time for his death to go, because he was promised to stay here until the Savior came. We have the same thing, for those that are LDS, you've got the same comment made in the Book of Mormon to three of his disciples. They will stay on the earth until the Lord comes to see the fulfillment of all of his works. All right. In 1950, a Jewish historian was writing in what's called the Jewish Hope, a newspaper describing some of the things that had gone on during the revolution or the War of Independence for Israel the year and a half before. And he writes of two incidences that illustrate God's hand in fighting for Israel. The two or three guns they possessed had to be rushed from one point to another to give the Arabs the impression that they had many of them. The Jews had quite a few tin cans, which they beat as they shot the guns, giving the impression of many shots. But as the pressure was too great, they were unable to hold the lines any longer, and finally decided to give up the city. At this critical moment, God showed them he was on their side, for he performed one of the greatest miracles that ever happened. The Arabs suddenly threw down their arms and surrendered. When their delegation appeared with the white flag, they asked, "Where are the three men that led you, and where are all the troops we saw?" But you said they didn't know anything about these three men, for this was their entire force. The Arabs said that they saw three men in white robes with long beards, who warned them that if they did not fight, to not fight any longer, otherwise they would all be killed. They became so frightened that they decided to give up. What an encouragement this was for the Jews, who realized that God was fighting for them. The Jews were encircled by the Egyptians, and humanly speaking, had absolutely no chance to escape. One morning, to the amazement of the Jews, the Arabs and the Egyptians suddenly gave up the fighting and surrendered. The Jews were first skeptical because they couldn't believe that the Arabs and the Egyptians would give up their strong position and surrender. But when they saw the Arabs threw down their arms, they learned that God had intervened for them. When they asked the Arabs and the Egyptians for the cause of their surrender, they told them that they had seen an old man with a long beard and flowing white robe who warned them not to fight any longer, otherwise they would all perish. That to me is courage on the part of the Jews. And it's exactly how they feel what's going on today. And I'm not taking sides on either one, but I need you to understand that the Jews demonstrate courage in the Word of God to them. That is a hero to me. Any guesses who this guy might be? We know him better many years later with a pose like this.
Yay, Napoleon.
Napoleon. So this is a younger day. I need Napoleon at 14. He's 22 in this picture. So this is the youngest picture I could find of Napoleon for my story. But anyway. While Napoleon was in military school, there was 150 boys in this military school. And in 1783, they had a long winter with lots of snow. And at this particular time in his training, he was learning about fortifications and strategy. And they would often, during recess, time off, whatever it was, go out in the fields and play war games and so on and so forth. And oftentimes Napoleon was chosen to be the leader of one of the groups. So they split the 150 boys into two groups of 75. This one particular day, Napoleon wants to test out this knowledge that he's learned about fortifications. So he tells his 75 boys, I'm going to divide you in half. Half of us are going to attack with snowballs. The other half are going to go to the back of the line and make snowballs for 10 minutes. Come on, Napoleon. We want to be out here where the fun is. We're going to be making snowballs back here. We want to go out here and fight. Just do what I tell you. I'll tell you later what's going on. So this battle begins. These guys are making snowballs, and Napoleon and his buddies, they're just heaving snowballs back and forth. We got ourselves a nice fight going on. 10 or 15 minutes later, Napoleon goes back to see how the guys are doing. They got a lovely stack of snowballs. Now he says, build a snow fort. This way, to cover the snowballs. Come on, Napoleon, we want out there. You guys are having all the fun. Just make the snow fort. I'll be back in 10 or 15 minutes. So he goes back out. They keep the snowball fight going. Napoleon checks on the fort. Fort's all ready. He orders a retreat. Come on, man. 2-1. We're winning this thing. You want to retreat? Retreat behind the snow fort. They get behind the snow fort. Now he's got 35 fresh arms with his retreating soldiers, classmates, behind a snow fort with ready-made snowballs. And just pummels the heck out of those guys. And wins. What happened to the snowfield? It's all mud! They've been running around for half an hour making a mess of the snow. There's no snow to make snowballs with. He's got a whole ton of snowballs back behind the snow fort and wins. That to me is leadership. He knew what he wanted to do, stuck to his guns, or stuck to his snowballs, and led the victory. Now, I don't agree with what Napoleon did later on in his life trying to conquer Europe. That's a whole other story. But I can appreciate him as a hero to me of a leader knowing what is right and knowing what he wants to do in regards to the snowball fight. Next one, integrity. We're going to pick on George Washington again. Now the war is over. The treaty has been signed. The British have finally left New York. Now Washington gets to bid farewell to his officers and go home to Mount Vernon and be with Martha. So it's time to bid farewell. We had been assembled but a few moments when His Excellency entered the room. His emotions, too strong to be concealed, seemed to be reciprocated by every officer present. Can you imagine saying goodbye to Washington? You know, nothing's happened yet with the Constitution and all that. They've been with this man for 8 years. He's going back to Mount Vernon. They're all going home. They couldn't hop in their car to go visit. They might not see each other ever again. And they're bidding farewell. 8 years together and winning a war? You need to share this with your children for them to appreciate the scene. After partaking of a slight refreshment, In almost breathless silence, the general filled his glass with wine and, turning to his officers, said, "With a heart full of love and gratitude, I now bid you leave. I most devoutly wish that your better days may be as prosperous and happy as your former ones have been, glorious and honorable." After the officers had taken a glass of wine, General Washington said, "I cannot come to each of you, but shall be obliged if each of you will come to me and take me by the hand. General Knox, who was nearest to him, turned to the commander, and with tear-covered face, without utterance, gripped his hand and gave him a kiss. And all of the officers did the same. Integrity. He was true to the end. He remained faithful to his crew, to his team, to his officers, to his soldiers. He'd rejected being offered kingship. Honor. Okay, I'll show you this picture first. Any ideas? I'll give you a hint, Civil War. Nope.
At the place where they signed the treaty?
Yes. McLean Farm. I've been on that front porch. We were there in 98. You were little. What's this? A picture of the surrender. In the house, Appomattox Courthouse is the name of a little settlement. It's not a courthouse. That's the name of the settlement. The McLean home was a home in the settlement that had been chosen. And the McLean family had moved there to get away from the war. And it ends up ending in their front room. Anyway, that's a side note. The table's still there. You're taken on tours to go through, and the table is still there where they signed. Supporting officers for Lee and for Grant are there in the side watching what's going on. General Grant's terms for surrender was go home. And Lee said, "You're not going to parade us on the streets of Washington?" "No. Go home." Grant wasn't interested in humiliating the defeated foe. They're already defeated. Why gloat? He had too much respect for General Lee and demonstrated that by the surrender terms. Then Grant put into the surrender terms, anybody who has a horse of their own, a gun of their own, take it with them. Because you're going to need it. This was springtime, April. The year before, Sherman had just marched through the South and obliterated the South. Destroyed any ability for them to plant winter crops. for them to have food in the spring. So the South had nothing. So Grant knew that they were going to need their horses to go plow the fields and their weapons to go hunt, to live. Obviously, Lee and his officers were quite thrilled that they weren't going to be humiliated in the streets of Washington. And the surrender terms were so generous. We're done. The war's over. Not that we're going to end feelings, but the war is over. Go home. I'm going home. You go home. As General Lee rose to leave, he said, I have 1,000 of your men that I have as your prisoner, as our prisoners. I shall be glad to send them into your lines, for I have no provisions for them. I have nothing for my own men. It was then that General Grant offered to send 25,000 rations to General Lee's army. And they walk out the door, and as General Lee rides off on Traveler, his horse, Grant salutes Lee. The winning general salutes the losing general. Why? Because of honor. Lee deserved the honor because of the kind of man he was. And Grant was the kind of man who recognized that person needs my honor. That's the story that you should get out of the Civil War. That your kids need to understand. Okay, yeah, there were 620,000 Americans that died. And yeah, the South won this battle and the North won this battle. It's kind of like with the Revolution. Okay, the British won this battle and the Americans won this battle. What's the lesson to be learned is the character of the heroes that were involved in the situations. For us to learn to emulate those character traits so that we can become like them and become a hero. Next one is faith. All right. I don't think anybody will get it. Anybody want to guess? This is the damsel by a well outside the city collecting water. It's Rebecca. Isaac's future wife. I like this story. Well, I like all these stories. Isaac's getting up there. Abraham says, okay, this young man needs to get married. But I don't want him to have a wife from the locals. And has Eleazar, his chief servant, take an oath that he will go back to Abraham's homeland, where he, when he left Ur of Chaldea, he went up by the headwaters of the Mesopotamia River, built the city Haran, and his brother and dad were there, and all the Nahor and all that kind of stuff. And then Abraham was later sent down to Canaan. Well, as a matter of fact, this is the geography that we're talking about here. So Abraham's down here, and Abraham's down here, and Rebecca's going to be up here. Abraham's old country. It's 468 miles. And Abraham tells the servant, I want you to go back and find a wife for Isaac. It's to be from my kindred. Okay. Makes the covenant and heads off. With 10 camels, it's going to take 17 days to get there. When he gets to the city, he kneels by the water, or by the well, and makes a deal with the Lord. O Lord God of my master Abraham, I pray thee, send me good speed this day, and shew kindness unto my master Abraham. Behold, I stand here by the well of water, and the daughters of the men of the city come out to draw water. And let it come to pass that the damsel to whom I shall say, let down thy pitcher, I pray thee, that I may drink. And she shall say, drink, and I will give thy camels drink also. Let the same be she that thou hast appointed for my servant Isaac, and thereby shall I know that thou hast showed kindness unto my master Abraham. So that's what Rebecca does. She doesn't know who this guy is. He's sitting by a well of water. Asks her for a drink. She said, okay, I'll give you a drink, and I'll also water your camels. Do you know how much water a camel drinks? 50 gallons.
That's cool.
Times 10. And she's offered to feed or water the camels from some yo-yo that she hasn't the foggiest idea who is. But the Lord impressed her to offer that. And so she does. Now the servant knows, there's Isaac's wife. And so the servant tells her what his errand was, how she had fulfilled it. And she said, okay, let me tell my family. And he puts on a couple of bracelets and earrings as a gift. She goes and tells her family who this guy is. And says, oh, Abraham's servant. We know who he is. So they bring him in. He tells his story. They all agree. The next day, he spends the night. The next day, the servant wants to go back. And the family says, the women said, you know, can we have her for a couple of days? The servant said, don't hold me back. The Lord has shown his hand. I'm to take her back. He said, okay, ask the damsel. So they ask him, it's okay, I'll leave. The ultimate blind date. Tom met my wife. We tried to beat them, but we got engaged we dated for 5 days, knew each other for 5 weeks, got engaged in 5 months, had 5 children, have 15 grandchildren, we're stuck on 5. We have 15 grandchildren. One of our children is right here. Anyway, so I kind of have an idea about a blind date, but an ultimate blind date. Yeah, I'm headed off to go see my husband, not just to go on a date with this guy. I'm getting hitched with this guy. That is faith on Rebecca's part. My last one is wisdom. Okay, let's test you on this. You have a tough time. Oh, very good. George Washington. kind of hard to tell from the picture. This is General Braddock. This is during the French and Indian War in 1755. Washington is a lieutenant in the British Army. They're fighting the French and the Indians, and he's an officer, a lieutenant in the British Army at this battle. Braddock is an arrogant son of a gun. Washington and Benjamin Franklin tried to tell Braddock, you don't fight from the middle of the road with red jackets on and a white cross in the middle as a target. They're going to hide behind rocks and trees and will beat the snot out of you if you try and fight from the middle of the road. I'm General Braddock. No one's going to tell me how to fight a war. We are British. We will do normal. Fine. The Indians gun him down. Washington, being a true blue British officer, only a lieutenant, remember the 1755, so we're a long way from what we've talked about here. He's running around on his horse. Come on, guys, you know, fight, fight. But they're hiding behind, you know, we're going to fight the way I'm going to, but we're going to try and win this battle. French and Indian War finally ends. Now we're up to 1770, and Washington and his doctor and good friend, Craik, are off in the Ohio Valley. Survey. People starting to move toward the west over the Appalachians into Ohio Valley, Tennessee Valley, and so forth. The chief on that day with the Indians that killed Braddock learns that Washington's in the neighborhood and wants to have a powwow. So they gather together for this powwow. And the chief says, his name is Red Hawk, I am the chief and ruler over my tribes. My influence extends from the waters of the Great Lakes to the far Blue Mountains, which would have been like the Appalachians. So that's the area we're talking about. It was on the day when the white man's blood mixed with the sight streams of our forest that I first beheld this chief, Washington. I called to my young men and said, mark yon tall and daring warrior. He is not of the Redcoat tribe. He hath an Indian's wisdom, and his warriors fight as we do. Himself is alone exposed. Quick, let your aim be certain, and he dies. Our rifles were leveled, rifles which, but for you, knew not how to miss. 'Twas all in vain. A power mightier than we shielded you. Seeing you were under the special guardianship of the Great Spirit, we immediately ceased firing at you. I am old and shall soon go to be gathered to my council fires and with my fathers in the land of shade. But before I go, there is something I wish to speak unto this man in the way of prophecy. That Great Spirit protects that man, pointing at Washington, and makes and guides his destiny. He will become a chief of nations, and a people yet unborn will hail him as their founder. I am come to pay homage to the man. You cannot die in battle. Wisdom is number 7. What I tried to do with my history curriculum, and you're welcome to come out to the booth to see, it takes time to find all of these stories to incorporate them into the main event that's going on. To appreciate everything that's going on, blending secular and religious history together. That's how you teach history. If you want to know how somebody is, you need to learn not only how they are, but their religious background as their motivating factor, why they do anything that they do. You take religion away, history is dull, dry, and boring. I've had fun over the years putting all of these stories together in my history curriculum so that parents have this information to be able to share with their children. I try to avoid mother burnout, as I call it, my wife and I. You're busy raising a family, taking care of them, and dealing with that spouse of yours. The wives are okay. You guys, you're the problem child. They don't have time to research all this stuff. But putting it into history helps the kids understand why things happen. Who these heroes are in these extraordinary circumstances. When Abraham went down to Egypt, he turns to Pharaoh and says, or turns to Sarah and says, tell Pharaoh that my wife. Why? What's that got to do with it? The Lord's always talking about husbands and wives. What's this brother-sister business that you're talking about? I also go into a study of the secular history. So here I'm talking about religious. Now I'm going into the secular side. What's in that Egyptian culture that would cause Abraham to say that? We learn in their culture, in their mythology, that their gods and goddesses were brothers and sisters married to each other. That relationship was sacred. If Pharaoh would have killed Abraham and kept Sarah as a concubine, he would violate his own parents' marriage covenant. And he was the son of Amun-Re, the head sun god, and he would cease to be Pharaoh. But if you don't put the secular in with that religious part of the story, you don't understand why. Now you do why he said, this is my sin. Pharaoh later apologizes for his intent. And Abimelech, a couple chapters after that, makes history interesting, fun, and exciting for the kids, gives them something to identify with, and to become the kind of people that God wants them to be.